Welcome to the Comics Canon, the podcast that reads, reviews, and renders judgment on the greatest comic book stories of yesterday and today. In this episode, we go back to the future to discuss Wolverine, Old Man Logan, collecting Wolverine issues 66 through 72, and Wolverine, Old Man Logan, Giant Size Number 1, published by Marvel Comics. Join us as we ask the burning questions. How good is this story really? And does it belong in that body of great comic book works known as the Comics Canon? My name is Kevin Morrow.
And my name is Old Man Holman. I mean, Kurt Holman. Just to, before we get started, the fact that one of these is called Wolverine Old Man Logan Giant Size reminds me of at a comic book store I used to go to, someone had like did a handwritten cartoon on like the cash register, and it was like for comic book titles that sound like they're dirty but they're not, and it was Giant Size Man Thing Number 1.
Nice.
I was always kind of amused by that. You know, I wish I knew who it was so I could give them the specific credit. You know.
So we're talking about Old Man Logan, and why are we doing that today?
We are doing that because the movie Logan, the new, the 10th movie in the X-Men universe is coming out shortly. And I've actually seen Logan at the time of this recording, and Kevin has not, you know. And,
no, I have not. Yeah. You invited me to the screening, and I wasn't able to make it. But I do have some questions for you about the movie.
Okay.
How is it at capturing the book? How's the Hulk gang, for example? How does the Venom T-Rex look?
Well, you know that they don't have the rights to those. First, number one, that they don't have the rights to those characters. And I'm pretty sure you can tell from the commercials with the Johnny Cash songs and the versions of Amazing Grace that they're not going for the Mad Max style post-apocalyptic vibe that the comic book is going for.
Probably, that's probably a wise move.
Yeah. There's a little overlap between the two, and both of them are like follow sort of a classic Western archetype, I would say, but that the archetypes are slightly different, but have a lot of similarity. So there are no dinosaurs imported from the Savage Land. There's no, you know.
You don't see Wolverine killing all the X-Men.
Yeah. You don't see the Baxter Building ruins laying on top of the giant skeleton of Loki in the middle of the Midwest, you know.
Yeah. So, yeah. No, knowing that the Logan movie was coming up and having heard that it was that it used some of this as source material, we thought that this would be a good thing to do. And even though it doesn't hew especially closely, it is obviously the closest thing to a touchstone that that the movie has to anything in the current comics.
Yeah. And Old Man Logan itself has a following, we would say, no matter, I mean, we'll talk about our feelings in just a minute, but the fact that...
Oh, yes, we will.
The fact that they announced and they had the trailer and people were like, oh, this might be based on Old Man Logan, you know, so it was one that they would point to and say, hey, let's check this out.
So why don't we go get started and go ahead and jump into the creators and the summaries, and then we'll just...
Then we'll jump into that. Yeah, you don't know what I think of this yet. So
I can only
guess. I'm pretty sure what you do, but
yeah. Okay, so the parties responsible for Wolverine, Old Man Logan, writer Mark Miller, a Comics Canon alumnus from Civil War,
and his artist on Civil War.
Yeah, Steve McNiven, the penciler, also from Civil War. Inker Dexter Vines with Mark Morales and Jay Leiston. Colors by Morty Hollowell with help from Christina Strain, Justin Ponsor, Jason Keith, Paul Mounts, and Nathan Fairbairn. Letters by VC's Corey Pettit, assistant editor Jody LeHoyp. I'm sure I mangled that and I'm sorry. Editors John Barber with an assist from Janine Schaefer on Giant Size Number 1.
Okay, so it starts with issue 66. In post-apocalyptic Sacramento, 50 years from now, Logan, formerly Wolverine, has forsworn violence to farm with his wife and two children. When they fail to make their rent, young members of the Hulk gang beat up Logan and demand double rent the following month. Later, Hawkeye, now blind, proposes that Logan drive him to New Babylon on an East Coast delivery job for $500. Logan accepts and they set off in the Spider-Mobile.
Issue 67. In San Francisco, Hawkeye implies he's dealing drugs. Finding buildings undermined by the Mole Man's Moloids, they clash with a gang of Ghost Riders, although Logan refuses to fight back. Passing through Hammer Falls, Nevada, they see crowds hoping for the heroes to return and are waylaid by Ultron 8. Hawkeye learns that his daughter Ashley, who has taken Spider-Man's mantle, has been captured by the new Kingpin.
Issue 68. Hawkeye offers Logan double to drive him to Salt Lake City for a rescue mission. In the city, the new young Kingpin has Ashley's teammates eaten by dinosaurs before a crowd. Hawkeye and Logan mount a rescue by driving the Spider-Mobile off a nearby roof and crashing into the building where Ashley is being held. Freed, Ashley murders the Kingpin, revealing her plan was always to take his place. She threatens to kill Hawkeye, and Logan reluctantly comes to his aid.
Issue 69. Logan grabs Hawkeye and drives from building to building to escape. While being pursued through the desert, they're swallowed by an earthquake. At the bottom of a chasm, Logan saves Hawkeye and drives the Spider-Mobile up the cave wall to the surface. In South Dakota, they pass Mount Rushmore, now bearing the Red Skull's face. At a bar in Iowa, Logan nearly kills a bullying stranger before stalking off. "What did they do to you?" Hawkeye asks, and Logan agrees to tell him.
Issue 70. Flashback to 50 years earlier. Logan, Jubilee, and the rest of Professor X's students are attacked by multiple supervillains. Logan kills them all so the young mutants can escape, until the last one, Bullseye, says, "You're supposed to be our friend." Mysterio appears and reveals that it was all an illusion, and it's my illusion, Michael, and Logan has just killed the X-Men. Half mad with grief, Wolverine allows a train to run over him, and vows never to use its claws or harm another person again.
Issue 71. Back in the present, a T-Rex with the Venom symbiote attached chases Logan and Hawkeye into Illinois, where they're saved by an aging Black Bolt. They're transported to the Forbidden Quarter and briefly given aid by Emma Frost, who reveals that mutants are no longer being born. They leave with Dr. Doom watching from a distance. Upon arrival in New Babylon, Hawkeye meets his contact, Tobias, and explains to Logan that he's not selling drugs, but super soldier serum to the Rebel Alliance. But Tobias reveals that the Alliance is just a sting operation, and he and his fellow S.H.I.E.L.D. agents shoot our heroes.
Issue 72. The Red Skull flashes back to the death of Captain America. In his trophy room, he inspects the corpses of Hawkeye and Logan, who is, of course, not dead. They fight, and Logan uses Captain America's shield to kill the skull. Logan takes the money and dons Iron Man's armor to escape and fly back to California. He returns in time, only to learn that the Hulk gang got bored and have killed his family anyway. Logan finally unsheaths his claws. Snicked.
Wolverine, Old Man Logan, Giant Size Number 1. So, yeah, Wolverine kills the Hulk gang members one by one and blows up Banner's trailer park compound. He confronts Bruce Banner, an elderly super-strong human who may have brain damage due to radiation. Banner hulks out into gigantic form and eats Logan, but a few hours later, Logan slashes out from inside, leaving Banner dead. 1 month later, Wolverine says goodbye to his family's graves and rides off into the sunset, planning to raise an infant Hulk and just maybe take down the supervillains.
Okay, let me say, I had not read this yet when we decided to do this. You gave me this after when we recorded our last episode. And I had, you know, I wasn't a huge fan of Civil War, as we discussed in our Civil War episode. And that was one of the Mark Miller stories that I liked, comparatively speaking, because I'm not a huge fan of his work. So I went into this with super low reserved expectations and liked it more than I expected.
Really?
Yeah. I was kind of, it had a point where it lost me, and we'll get to that, you know. Okay, I'll get to it now. Once you bring in cannibalism and incest, okay, that's where you lose me with my superhero story, you know. Yeah,
so that's what it took.
Yeah, okay. There are other things, you know, but I'll just put that out there now, you know. But kind of up until then, I thought it's like, you know, this is kind of an interesting post-apocalyptic version of the Marvel Universe, where you see these kind of depraved versions of, you know, the villains and the heroes. And, you know, so it's like I never kind of knew where it was going, and I was kind of curious. And it was more interesting to me than, say, the Brian Bendis Age of Ultron futuristic apocalyptic story from a few years ago. So I was like, okay, I'm kind of curious. And a lot of the quote-unquote action scenes I thought were set up pretty interestingly, you know. So if it was a big dumb action movie, in some ways it kind of worked as a big dumb action movie for me. So I'm saying right now, it's like I like this more than I thought I would.
Emphasis on the dumb.
Yeah.
That I gotta admit, I'm a little surprised. I will say that I had read this previously. I bought the trade paperback soon after it came out. So that was probably in 2009 or 10 when I bought it and remembered enjoying it, but it didn't leave much of an impact on me. Mm-hmm. So I was rereading it this time on tablet because mm-hmm. I'd loaned you this copy, and it was a completely different experience. let's say that I was exasperated a lot.
Okay. Now, this is not what you're implying, but let me ask it anyway. Do you find the experience of reading on tablet affects you differently than reading on paper? And just kind of not just with just in general.
It does. And to go back to our last episode as an example, our guest Glenn Weldon, when we were talking about The Court of Owls, was talking about how much he liked the sequence where the action on the page tilts and you have to hold the book sideways or upside down at points. And that was miserable for me because the tablet kept correcting it. Uh-huh. And finally, I had to set it on the floor and I had to move around so that I could read those pages. Mm-hmm. And I did not enjoy that at all. It's a different experience.
I'm reading a comic book. I don't want to move around.
It is a different experience. I don't know how much that has informed my thoughts on this particular series, but who knows? We'll get into that.
Yeah. All right. Well, to get into some things, I'll start out with a really big criticism of it. You know, the story has to unfold the way it unfolds, you know, and this is kind of a riff on a classic Western trope of sort of the old gunslinger has forsworn violence, he's giving it up, and then bad guys get involved and he tries not to get back to his violent ways, but they just keep coming and they're just so ruthless and bad, so he ends up having to, like, you know, revert to his old killer ways and, you know, and kind of, you know, have the kind of the catharsis that the whole story has been building for, you know. And when you find out, like, why Logan quit, because he killed all his friends, and after having, you know, this history in the comics of being a killer and trying to control his killer side, you know, it's like, it's kind of a, you know, justifiable thing, you know. It's like, okay, it makes sense that he would not want to do this again, given the situation he's in. But, okay, so when we find them, they're like farmers. They have like this farm compound in the middle of what looks like a barren wasteland. You know, it's like, what do they farm exactly? Because we see some like pigs in a pig pen, you know, and that they've had apparently some issues with like radiation poisoning with the pigs or stuff like that, you know. And he's got like a wife and two kids, you know. So
they have a tractor, although they don't seem to have any crops.
There's no visible crops, you know, and for kind of an in-universe sort of no prize explanation, it's like, well, this is this sort of post-apocalyptic place. Maybe stuff has gone horribly wrong on their farm, and it used to be green and flourishing, and now it's like dried up and desolate, you know. But they can't make their rent, and the Hulk gang shows up. And this is a gang who we kind of, it seems like it's probably common knowledge. We don't know this for sure, but, you know, they're this family because Bruce Banner has mated with his cousin, She-Hulk, in this. We don't know what happened to them. Most of the ones we see are his grandkids, so there's like this kind of whole generation going on, probably intermixing with each other, one would assume, you know.
An awful lot of them, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. And that they are, like, in the last issue, they don't really get to this until the last issue, but they're just, like, straight up eating people, you know, and it's like, and when someone says, it's like, you know, it's like, oh, you know that we eat people, you know, something like that, you know, and it's like, I'm not going to excuse anything that bad guys do, but if you're like staying on this barren farm that where nothing grows and your landlords are a bunch of, you know, inbred cannibals, I mean, why stay there? I mean, it's kind of on you, you know, if you're going to leave your family in this horrible situation, you know, so, and anyway, but, you know, That's a little unfair, I gotta say, but, you know.
No, I think that's a very good point. Yeah. You do see that there are other places that one can live. Obviously, it's not particularly easy to get from one area to the other unless you have the Spider-Mobile.
Yeah.
Which I remember reading the comic book in which the Spider-Mobile first appeared when I was a very young child.
Oh, I do too, yeah.
I don't remember much about it, and I could have like tried to dig it up and read it before this podcast, and I didn't, just to see, like, does it really do all the things that it can do in here? Like, it straight up scaling walls.
Yes, it can straight up scale walls. It can literally drive on walls. I remember that very well. It had web shooters built in, like under the headlights. So, you know.
Which I wish we could have seen that in action.
Yeah. At what point does that become, you know, a bridge too far? But, you know, it's like, and that's one of the things I liked about this. It's like they're driving the Spider-Mobile around. It's like, I think one level is like this crazy, dark, depressing, violent, you know, situation. But it's like, we're going to bring this super silly thing and it kind of becomes cool in this weird way, you know. And it's kind of in a reverse way, when we first see the Hulk gang, there's like three of them and they're riding the Fantastic Car and they've like put graffiti over the fours, you know, so yeah. It's like putting their own stamp on it. And it's like the Fantastic Car and the Spider-Mobile are kind of like mirrors of each other in that way. Like one's being used by the bad guys, one by the good guys.
I will say that the Spider-Mobile has to have the best shocks on the planet, especially because we learn that Hawkeye, and we'll get to Hawkeye in a second, is carrying not drugs, but a suitcase full of vials of super soldier serum. And they are doing all these fast and furious stunts, driving through buildings and across into other buildings, straight up off the... diving off of a cliff at the beginning of the second issue and landing unharmed at the bottom of, you know, a valley, who knows how far down. And nothing happens to any of these vials. Yeah. Like,
I think we can save some of our Hulk gang discussions for maybe towards the end, because that's when they kind of come into focus. But one of them we see, he's wearing a trucker cap that has the word green neck on it. Like, it's, they're not rednecks, they're green necks, you know. And it's like, yeah. Very clever.
Very subtle. So we meet Logan and his family, and they're really nothing but ciphers. There's not enough time for us to get to know them and to feel the loss that you have to know is coming, because we know where this is going, I think, from the first couple of pages.
Well, I will say that we get Logan's attachment to them, and he says he doesn't want to sell his kids' toys, you know, because he talks about selling their Xbox, and it's funny that it's like the Xbox still works, but, you know. And the son pulls a gun on the Hulk gang when they're beating up Logan, and so you get a sense that he's, you know, going to stick up for his dad, you know. Yeah. So I thought that was fairly sweet, you know.
Yeah.
But it's like, it would be nice to know, like, who the wife is and how, what kind of relationship they have, you know, because it's like... So, okay, she's been married to Logan for 20 years, apparently. It's like, we know nothing about her, really. So,
do we even know her name?
I don't recall, but, you know, it may be in there. You know.
I will say that Steve McNiven does a very nice job drawing the wife. She does look like a hardscrabble farmer's wife straight out of Central Casting. Mm-hmm. Like, you could have seen her in Unforgiven or something like that. And he does the landscape well. For the most part, I don't have an issue with the art in this book. I think McNiven's a fine artist.
I think that the art's good for this story, and I think kind of the quote-unquote direction, like the action movie direction, is pretty good for like the action scenes and things like that.
Yeah, they're not hard to follow, like action sequences in some of the stuff that we've discussed can be. But as I said, we kind of know where this is going. As soon as Logan says he's never going to pop his claws again, and as soon as he assures his wife that they're going to be back in time, you have a suspicion that he's not going to be back in time.
Well, at least you know that like the claws are coming out by the end of this.
Yeah. And the only question is, how will Mark Miller sustain a sense of excitement and suspense and stakes across these eight issues that it takes to get there? And one of the problems of this book for me is that it's not one sustained narrative. It's point A over here, point B in issue 72, and then just a lot of space filling in the middle, it seems.
Well, it's episodic and picaresque, one might say. I mean, it's a road story, and it's like they have different adventures as they go along, you know. Yeah.
And let's talk about Hawkeye for a second.
Yeah. Well, one thing that I don't know if this is intentional, but it struck me as kind of funny that you have, you know, Hawkeye, like the superhero archer who is blind when we see him. And in The Dark Knight Returns, which we've done in one of our episodes, you know, you have the superhero archer who's missing an arm in the, you know, futuristic situation. So
I was going to say that I don't know who this guy is, but he's not any Hawkeye that I recommend. And we can get into that a little bit later. I have something in the recommendations that ties into that. But I wrote in my notes, he reminds me of a cross between Green Arrow from The Dark Knight Returns and the dude from The Big Lebowski. Yeah. He's not a Hawkeye that I recommend. He's that I remember, you know, but he's very much this kind of hippie type, you know, doesn't believe Logan necessarily when he keeps saying that he's forsworn violence and isn't going to pop his claws. And obviously is comfortable living on a shadier side than, you know, than we're used to seeing, which I, you know, I thought was a nice touch, even though I got to say this right up front. I feel like I have to walk a line very carefully here. And I kind of resent this book for doing this to me because at times, like I feel myself slipping into like a stereotypical caricature of a comic book fanboy. Like that's not how the character is supposed to look, you know, like, I don't want to be that guy, but I have to say, this leapt out at me like, this is not Hawkeye. This is just a guy, a blind guy with a bow and arrow.
Well, what specifically struck you as out of character for him? Because, I mean, I don't disagree, but I'm not sure if I would point out to like how different he seems.
Well, part of the problem with that is that it kind of depends on the Hawkeye that you're used to. Yeah. And the one that from, say, the 80s, say in the Mark Gruenwald miniseries, is very different from, say, the Matt Fraction Hawkeye, who is somewhat similar to, but still very different from, say, Jeremy Renner in the MCU movies. Mm-hmm. This Hawkeye just seems like he's a bit of a stoner and doesn't take things particularly seriously. Mm-hmm. And it's not like you can't draw a line between the various more heroic iterations of the character, and Hawkeye's never been staunchly, stoically heroic like a Steve Rogers type. Yeah. You know, he does kind of have that, I don't want to say bad boy side, but he has a, you know, a different flavor to him. Mm-hmm. You can draw a line between the two, but I feel like one isn't. Yeah. That you just need this character to serve this purpose in the story, and let's call him Hawkeye and give him a bow and arrow. That's how it fits to be. Your mileage may vary.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, I see him as being more laid back than I think of Hawkeye as being.
Yes.
But you know, it's like, it's 50 years in the future, you know, so.
Yeah, and that does buy you some leeway.
One can kind of hand wave away some continuity or personality changes because of the length of time that's happened there.
While we're talking about the fact that it's 50 years in the future, what is the economy in this world?
Yeah.
Because they live on this piece of crap farm, you know, that they can't seem to get anything to grow. Mm-hmm. They're behind on their rent. Mm-hmm. The guy Logan tried to sell their pigs to wouldn't even give him $20 for them.
Yeah.
And Hawkeye says, I'll give you $500 if you drive with me out to the East Coast. That's a lot of rent.
Well, I think we should assume that at some point they kind of revalued the currency.
Right.
And they're probably using like Red Skull bucks now, you know, so that, and so it's not like, you know, inflation has gone through, but it maybe it reverts to like something closer to like what the English pound used to be, you know?
Yeah. But like reading this, I was like, is there rent like $20 a month?
Yeah.
Like, cause Logan's like, you know, this will set us up for a long, long time.
Yeah. Well, let's get on the road.
Yes.
And, one thing that like kind of helped get me on the book side to a point was the fact that it has just a big map of the country. And I like a big map, you know, and it's like, there's like Hulkland formerly the Abominations territory, which is California and all the other places, you know, and it has like their route that they're going to take, you know, so it's almost like sort of a crazy comic book sci-fi version of the Raiders of the Lost Ark map, you know, so I don't want to dwell on that, but it's like, I always like a good map, you know.
And I would have, having reread this for the first time since the last time I read it, the cynical part of me was going to say, oh, look, it's divided up into different kingdoms, just like Game of Thrones, although the TV show hadn't come out until 2011. Mm-hmm. And so I can't accuse Mark Miller of ripping that off. Mm-hmm. But yeah, it's funny that it's subdivided, like, and these are the bad guys that won out, that each got a portion, like the Red Skull, who's, it's not really...
He's identified just as the president at this point in the book.
It's not really spelled out, but you get the sense that he was one of the architects behind this whole supervillain team up.
Yeah. We may never have said that what brought on this apocalypse was that, like, all supervillains everywhere came together. And one of them said, it's like, well, there's like 20 villains to every hero, which is kind of like a, you know, a convention from the comics where, like, each superhero has a rose gallery. And so since you can't do the same villain every time, you know, there's more of them, you know. So it's like, we just get together and we'll be undefeatable, you know. And it's like, well, look, that kind of makes sense, you know. But yeah, so the Red Skull, it is implied, was the architect behind it.
Yeah. So he has his quarter.
Yeah.
The Kingpin had kind of part of the Midwest, which doesn't make a lot of sense.
He had the kind of the, it's almost like time zones we see. Yeah. And it's like Red Skull's like had like the Eastern time. Like Kingpin has kind of like mountain time and that kind of, you know, Los Angeles or Las Vegas, you know, South Salt Lake City area. The Abomination and the Hulk had California, and the middle part of it was like Dr. Doom, and I think there was a part that was undefined.
Yeah. And again, part of me is like, why would the Kingpin settle for like the, you know, the mountain time zone?
Yeah, it seems
rather like, than, but like if you ask too many of those questions,
yeah,
the whole thing's gonna.
Well, if you think of it as being maybe he was like had been in Las Vegas and, you know, but it's kind of, it's a little vague. It's, you'd think he would like, I'm not leaving New York. Are you kidding? You
know? Yeah. So anyway, so they have to kind of make their way through these various zones. Mm-hmm. And early on, we see the Moloids from the Mole Man, you know, pretty much from the very first Marvel comic ever.
Yeah. And
Fantastic Four number one.
There were, I don't remember when it started, and I don't even know if it was a Mole Man book, but there was a story where, like, I think it was like the Mole Man, you know, they would dig under buildings and the buildings would like collapse, like not break apart, but just sort of slide down like Legos, you know, into the ground. And so I thought it was neat that they would, you know, bring that back here, you know.
Yeah.
And they're like termites, you know, eating away at cities and buildings and things.
Yeah, like so I will say, I feel like that does a good job of explaining where the heck everyone is, because just having all the supervillains in the world attack all the superheroes by itself, you don't think it would cause all this damage.
Yeah. But they imply also later that, like, that Europe is destroyed. And so this, I mean, it wasn't just like killing the heroes. It was like destroying lots of stuff.
Yeah. But I have to ask, while we're talking about the map, why is there a paste pot creek?
Well, it might be like in the first Superman movie where Lex Luthor psychic gets Otisburg, you know. It's like, okay, Trapster, you can have paste pot creek, you know. Why it's even on the map, I guess, is the question.
Yeah. I mean, the thing is, the guy's gone by Trapster for like decades. But anyway, whatever.
Or it might be like, okay, you can have a place, and it's going to be called Paste Pot Creek, and it's like, I'm trying to live that down, you know. We can go through some of these, but it's like there are ghost riders who show up, but they're not like Johnny Blaze ghost riders. They just seem like a generic motorcycle gang who has like a flame and skull motif.
Yeah.
What's kind of more interesting is that Ultron 8 shows up and is not a villain, but is just like a husband and just a nice guy, you know? And I kind of like that they didn't explain that. It's like he's, you know, living with the mother of Ashley, you know, and so he's sort of like a surrogate father.
Yeah,
you know?
One of Hawkeye's ex-wives, right, and a daughter of Peter Parker, Spider-Man.
Yeah.
Which explains why Ashley takes on the Spider-Man guys. The mom thinks that she and two friends have dressed up as superheroes because they want to be good guys and overthrow the Kingpin. And we find out, no, it's because she just wants to take over. But anyway.
Yeah, they sort of imply, there's a part where Hawkeye says that he never saw her as like the hero type, which is sort of like hanging a lantern on that.
Right.
You know? But yeah, I think we can jump to the Salt Lake City part, you know, and it's like, and there's a scene, it's like in the, I don't know if you ever read the Stephen King novel, The Stand, but that, you know, ends with, you know, some of the heroes being like killed in this like Las Vegas stadium in front of the villain. And it's like, it's kind of like that with the stadium and the two of Ashley's friends who are like would-be or wannabe punishers and daredevils, you know, eaten by dinosaurs. Like the first time we've seen dinosaurs, you know, and the kingpin is like not Wilson Fisk, but this big African-American guy who I wonder if it's like kind of a wink to the Daredevil movie where I believe Michael Clark Duncan played the kingpin, right. You know, so.
I hadn't thought of that. Mm-hmm. So yeah, and he doesn't seem all that intimidating,
no.
But he's not around for very long.
Yeah, yeah. And they imply that Magneto had been in charge of this territory and they defeated Magneto somehow. And they imply that
that's Magneto, right. So the original Kingpin wouldn't have gotten it anyway.
Yeah.
So
the suggestion is that Magneto was worse than what we're seeing here. So we kind of don't really know what that's about. And right. I like it that this doesn't explain all this stuff, that you're kind of left to imagine the giant fight and how these villains kind of evolved into what we see now, you know. But one thing that kind of annoys me is like they have their Logan and Hawkeye are like, okay, how are we gonna get in and get her out of this? They figure out where she is, you know, and it's like, and his plan is to kind of just crash in and save her. And you know, it's, I always prefer in like a action movie, whatever, where you see characters like have a plan that's like a smart plan. It's like, we're just going to do this dumb plan that's not actually a plan, you know?
Yeah.
There's a part in our Revenge of the Sith where it's like, we're going into a trap. And it's like, what are we going to do? And Obi-Wan Kenobi, Ewan McGregor says, spring the trap, you know? Which is kind of a nice moment for Ewan McGregor and, you know, not a super well-acted movie. But it's also like, well, how about do something kind of smarter than this, you know? It's like, can the writer like think ahead enough to construct like a clever, like, you know, a diversion. And then we come in with this way and then we get out with this other way, you know? So they rescue her and it turns out that she's actually bad and she's starting to kill her own father.
Yeah. Yeah. And so Logan is forced to rescue him and then they drive away and they're chased by everyone. Mm-hmm. And then conveniently the ground drops out from underneath them because of the moloids. Mm-hmm. And they've been built up all this time. And this is kind of like their big moment. We don't really see them after this. Mm-hmm. And I'm kind of disappointed that there isn't a bigger payoff to their time fighting the moloids.
They don't actually fight them. Wolverine just kind of like turns a light on and they recoil. And then he kind of gets Hawkeye back into the Spider-Mobile and they're able to drive straight up the wall, you know. But they're kind of like hunching around like Nosferatu-y type things, you know.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. But, you know, I liked them. I mean, there wasn't like a big fight, but I enjoyed them as these little, you know, chud-like monsters, you know. But there's not a whole lot else, you know, for a while. There's that part where they drive through the Midwest and you see the Baxter building on this giant skeleton, and which was Loki, and it's like, and you kind of wonder, it's like, okay, what's the Baxter building doing here in the middle of the country? And like, why is Loki was he a giant, you know? So
yeah,
it implies that some real stuff went down, you know.
I do like that a couple of times Hawkeye says, man, you really missed a fight that night. Yeah. And that pretty much leads us to Logan's story about that night and what happened to him. And as you said, like, that is really an effective and very chilling story. And like, yeah, that you really feel something there. Like, I was actually like, I think he'd be more broken, but as you mentioned, it's been 50 years, a long time has passed, and he's only been a farmer probably for the last 20
of it. They
say
like 20,
yeah. So he had a few lost years, it's safe to say.
And it like at first it's like, you know, because we're primed to have like this big supervillain attack, and then all these supervillains seemingly attack the Professor X's mansion, and there's like Dr. Octopus and Mr. Hyde, and they don't identify them, so it's like, oh, it's all these guys from all these different superhero, you know, mythologies coming in at once. And it's sort of the sort of classic, you know, Wolverine Last Stand where he's like fighting everyone in sequence, and like there's this big bloodbath and all these bodies are basically piling up, you know. And then they kind of realize it's like, haha, but it's like these weren't actually the villains, they were your own teammates all along, you know?
And I have to admit, like, I bought in. Like, I was asking, well, why is Dr. Octopus there? Like, I understand Mr. Sinister, and I think that might be Strife. I don't really never read any of those Rob Liefeld comics. But like, what's that guy doing there? And what's his story?
Well, they don't have to have, you know, didn't have to get like just the Brotherhood of Evil Mutants to attack the X-Men, you know. So yeah. I mean, that's what kind of made it interesting and implied.
Like, wouldn't Dr. Octopus be busy, like, you know, fighting with everyone else to over who gets to kill Peter Parker?
Yeah.
You know, but, and then when he's saying, Cyclops, where is everybody? Even then, like, yeah. That should be a clue for you to pick up on that something's not right, and I did not. That's one of the two issues that I really like in this, because that is an effective, as I said, part, and it really, your heart really goes out to the character at that point.
And they show the scene where he, like, you know, lays his head on the railroad track, like the song "Poor, Poor, Pitiful Me," and it's like kind of almost a symbolic suicide, even though he can't actually kill himself. But he says, you know, he knew it wouldn't kill himself, but it would hurt. So it's like he's, you know, performing a penance of some kind, and maybe trying to obliterate himself, even though he knows that that won't be what permanently happens.
So. Then
the Venom dinosaur chases them, and that's when it starts to get a little off the rails for me, because it's like, okay, we're gonna just have a Venom dinosaur, you know. It's almost like, okay, we don't need this much stuff, you know. It's kind of fun and crazy, but they just kind of shoot at it and then get rescued, and you see kind of the Forbidden Quarter with like what remains of the Inhumans and the mutants, and Emma Frost is there. And the implication is that she married Dr. Doom.
Yeah.
I don't know if they actually quite come out and say it.
No, they don't say who she married, but she says that she entered into this marriage to save the rest of mutant kind.
Yeah.
And you do see Dr. Doom later. So, and she doesn't indicate that she's married to Black Bolt. So you kind of have to assume.
Yeah. And one of the implications, I think, is that I don't think they come out and say this, and it's not a very, they don't really do anything with it, but I think that they know, or at least Emma Frost, Dr. Doom knows that they're going to a trap, you know, because just seeing Dr. Doom the way they show him, you know, where he's like, he's like making it's like he's thinking something specific almost, you know. And so maybe Emma Frost doesn't know, but she's a telepath. How would she not know if, you know, so, and it's like, almost like, well, they don't owe them anything. So it's like, well, good luck, you know, you're on your path, you know.
One thing about that, to circle back a second, when you talked about the Venom dinosaur, I felt the same thing a little bit. And I also felt it when the Ghost Riders show up earlier. It reminded me of, this is back before even Image Comics started, so late 80s, early 90s, maybe right around 1990, Jim Valentino did a Guardians of the Galaxy comic with the original 30th century Guardians. And I read a few issues of those, and my overwhelming impression was that the hook was not so much futuristic space action, but seeing, you know, these Marvel concepts and icons in the 30th century. Like, there's a character called Rancor who's kind of like it's implied is like a descendant of Wolverine. You have a 30th century Ghost Rider, you know, things like that. And there are points where I feel like this is, you know, this is just kind of eating up the clock and throwing in, wouldn't it be cool, like, let's show what's happened to this character 50 years in the future, or let's throw in, you know, a nod to Ghost Rider or something like that, without really giving you anything of real substance.
Yeah, it probably wouldn't hurt for this to be one issue shorter, I would say. Either that or have it, each episode be a little bit more substantial, because as is, you know, they see Emma Frost and Black Bolt helps them with the Venom dinosaur. And it's kind of nice when she said, well, it's, you know, sensitive to sound, and Black Bolt has this super powerful voice. So, you know, that kind of goes together, but we don't really get any sense of story of what they're dealing with. You know, it just kind of goes from there to the skeleton of Giant Man, which is another, you know, cool, powerful image.
Pym Falls.
Yeah. And then to New Babylon, which I guess is Washington, D.C., and where this, you know, the deal happens, but it turns out to be, you know,
a sting operation. Yeah.
And it's like, and they're like the bad guys, including Tobias, who has a Hitler mustache, which kind of should be the giveaway. You know, they're working for S.H.I.E.L.D., who are the bad guys in this case, you know, and Hawkeye just gets kind of shot dead, you know, and that's kind of where the issue ends, you know.
And that leads to issue 72, which to me is one of my, it's my other favorite issue of this, because it actually furthers the story. You have Wolverine finally having some agency. There's, you know, him, he stops kind of, I hesitate to say feeling sorry for himself, because he does have a very good reason to sort of set down his claws, as it were. But he spends a lot of the time up until now, like, I'm not fighting. I'm not, you know, no, you can't make me, you know, finally his friend dies. And, you know, he had seen, whether he believed in it or not, some small spark of hope, you know, for change.
Yeah.
And now that it looks like it's been snuffed out, and he's confronted with the guy who, as we said, it's implied is one of the main architects behind this whole thing.
Yeah. And he's wearing Captain America's costume, you know, even though he's like an elderly Red Skull with his Red Skull face under the mask. Yeah.
And I like it. It's all too much for him, and he finally acts. And that was really satisfying to me, just after several issues of, you know, just ambling from place to place and Wolverine refusing to get involved. And finally, you know.
Well, one thing I want to say, this is kind of a side criticism, and it might be just me, but, you know, the Red Skull's kind of a boring villain, honestly. Yeah. You know, of all, like, classic Marvel villains like Loki or Doctor Doom, you know, or even like Norman Osborn, you know, he just doesn't have any real personality beyond being like the most evil villain of all villains. You know, like just the Nazi with skull face, you know, and science genius, whatever, you know.
I started to say a couple minutes ago, and again, my fear of, you know, falling into that fanboy caricature is like, Dr. Doom wouldn't be satisfied with just some little corner of it. You know, like the Dr. Doom, as I know him, like would want the whole thing.
Yeah.
You know, and I would have expected him to be the main architect.
You could have a whole story about Dr. Doom.
Yeah.
Or a whole issue, at least, to kind of explain why he's just occupying Chicago, it seems like.
Yeah. And Dr. Doom isn't necessarily a conventional Wolverine villain or X-Men villain, but then neither is the Red Skull.
Yeah.
So that really doesn't matter. Yeah. You know, as long as we're not going up against Magneto, like anyone almost can really work here.
But I guess it's a sign of like how bad things are that, you know, the most America hating villain of them all is in charge of America and has his face on Mount Rushmore, you know, but I just don't find him terribly interesting as a character. And in the kind of big fight scene, it's in like the Red Skull's trophy room. So he gets Captain America's shield and later gets Tony Stark's armor, you know, but, one of the kind of the problems with this is that, he, you know, uses the shield to sever the skull's head, or at least break his neck, you know?
Yeah.
And,
No, as I recall, it looks like a straight up decapitation.
Yeah. And, with it being kind of this whole big buildup, you know, it's like, I'm not going to fight, not hurt anyone, you know? And then he does this, which is like, okay, it's like, it seems earned enough for purposes, you know, but it's also like it undermines that big moment at the end of this where he pops his claws out, you know?
Yeah.
So it's like, you know, to scoot ahead, you know, he sees his dead family, you know, and like the person talking to him says like, you know, Logan, and you turn there's a 2-page spread of snicked, you know, and then he says the name's Wolverine, you know, but it's like, well, you just killed someone a few pages ago.
Yeah,
you know?
It does. Yeah, you're right. It does rob some of the impact of that moment. Yeah. And for a couple of reasons, I think we both agree that this whole story arc would have been better if it had ended here with issue 72, if they could have wrapped up, you know, the whole thing with his family dying, ideally. I'm not sure off the top of my head how you would do that, but I think it would have been a much tighter story. Anything we can do to not have most of Wolverine, Old Man Logan, giant size number one, the better. Let's just get into that, because I think that's the part where we both were
Well, one thing I will say is like, he you know, goes and starts killing them in like little groups, and like as like, you know, revenge movie scenes, like these first little scenes are actually pretty good, I think. You know, it's like two of them are like washing off and one gets pulled in the water.
Yeah, I'm not sure if they're like in a sewer or they're in a little creek or whatever, but they're like washing their blood stains off. Yeah. And so like apparently it just happened.
Yeah.
Like he just missed him, which rubs it in even, you know, rubs the salt in even a little bit more.
Yeah.
But then like one of them like disappears below the water, and the other one's like Earl or whatever the guy's name is.
And then he gets some others at a bar, you know, and then
cuts off the power.
And then there's like the Hulk compound trailer park, and one of them is like appears in the Fantastic Car with all these explosives, and that blows up, you know. So
don't forget the scene at the brothel.
The brothel, where the
big green guy with the green neck cap. You know, he and apparently some of his friends / cousins have made short work of the entire staff.
Yeah,
you know, and I'm glad we don't see any blood there, and it's just implied that they're worn out and that they all, you know, they'll wake up.
Thank heaven for small favors, you know.
But then he walks outside, and Wolverine is standing there. So, and then it leads to the scene where he's in all chained up in the Fantastic Car, and there's a bomb in his mouth.
Yeah.
And the Fantastic Car plows into the trailer park, and really, a trailer park?
Yeah. One of these like Hulk cousins, or brother cousins, you know, a pair are named Bo and Luke after the Dukes of Hazzard, and it's like, boy, I bet Mark Miller hurt his wrist patting himself on the back for that. You know, it's like, okay, come on. Because after a while, it just gets like the Wanted books or the Kick-Ass books when they kind of like, after like the first ones where they really start to be obnoxious and egregious, it kind of goes in that area, you know. And it's like, give me a darn break, you know. So, and then it's like you have this like the evil Bruce Banner, who's like super strong, even though he looks like an old man, and is fighting him, and then like turns into like a giant gray Hulk, and you know, we covered that in the thing, you know, in the summaries, you know, he like eats him, but then like a few hours later, it's like you ate someone with a healing factor, and then he like Wolverine pops out and he's dead, you know, and it's just sort of like gross, you know. And it's like one thing about, to kind of step back a bit about the genre of this sort of revenge story, you know, and it took me a while to kind of figure this, you know, in like following movies and comics and whatnot. But a lot of times you'll have like kind of the reformed violent character trying to be good, but then being pulled back, you know, it's like these things are kind of on the side of him being violent. You know, it's like, you know, it really doesn't, they don't really believe in pacifism. They're really basically pro-violence, you know, and some of them you can do interesting things with. A good one, it's like, even if he goes violent again, you get a sense that it's like a character's tragedy, you know, like I think Unforgiven does that to a certain point, you know, but it's like, we're going to promise you violence and tease out this violence, and then we're going to give it to you, you know? And I think this does it like 100%, you know? And it's almost like, wouldn't it be interesting to see a thing where he like renounces violence, but actually solves his problems in a different way? You know, it's like, we want to see him pop his claws and do the Wolverine thing. Cause you know, that's, and for what it's worth, an entertaining thought about the Wolverine character. But you know, what if he actually thought his way through the problem and like maybe Yojimbo'd the bad characters where he turned them against each other, you know, or something like that. So, you know, and you could actually keep this idea of pacifism actually being a good thing, you know, and not like this sort of thing that's kind of keeping him from his own true better self in a way. So that all just kind of, I'm not going to defend any of that, you know, it's just kind of irritating to me. You know?
No, I agree. And you're right about these kind of revenge stories. Mm. I think every now and then you do see a hero who like kind of regrets that this is what he's come to. Mm. And you would like to see at least a little bit of that, where if you have the violence at the end, that at least he's a little, you know, sad that there couldn't have been a better way.
Yeah.
I might be completely off base, but I feel like First Blood, the first Rambo movie, hints at that a little bit. Mm-hmm. He really just wanted to be a normal person and fit in. Yeah. And it was everyone else who drove him to this point to do the thing that he's best at, which isn't very nice to borrow Wolverine's phrase. But here, you're not going to get any of that because it's a Wolverine comic book. But with Mark Miller writing it, you're especially not going to get that. Because the violence is the whole point. Mm-hmm. And it feels like this last issue is sort of the dessert for what Mark Miller imagines is the typical Wolverine reader who just wants to see people get sliced and diced and slashed up.
Yeah.
And to see gory things like popping out of the Hulk's stomach, you know. I have to say, I have not met Mark Miller. I've read interviews with him. I've heard a couple of interviews with him on the Word Balloon podcast. He seems like a very nice guy and semi-thoughtful guy, but this story to me just feels as cynical as all get out.
Yeah. We're kind of talking about the work and recurring themes in his work that we find problematic, shall we say, you know.
Yeah.
So we're not kind of fans of that, but I mean, he has done work that has been quite good that hasn't kind of gone down this path, like, you know, Superman Red Sun.
That's exactly what I was going to say, yeah.
And that seems to be kind of the exception that proves the rule, you know, but there's a lot of stuff in this, like I said, that I like, you know, and so.
And when we did the Civil War episode, in the Spinnerack segment, I recommended his Wolverine Enemy of the State run on the Wolverine comic, which is basically Wolverine gets brainwashed by the Hand, I believe, and it's Wolverine versus the Marvel Universe for a good 6 issues. And that was done very well compared to this, which is...
And I feel like even this, if it had less, you know, gratuitous violence against, you know, innocent people and the incest and the cannibalism and all that, you know, I might be able to taken it a little bit better, you know. Although it might have been, it might have seemed less gratuitous and gross, you know. So, you know, I feel like there's a way to do this story that could have dialed it back from 10 to maybe 8.5, and it wouldn't have, you know, turned me against it so much.
Right. I agree. I like the setup, as I think you do. It's, you know, kind of a fun post-apocalyptic Mad Max thing. You like the idea that... I feel like we're Siskel and Ebert here.
Yeah.
You like the idea that a lot of the stuff isn't explained.
Yes.
There are a couple of things where I feel like some explanation would help, but I don't have a huge problem with that. But I think that we both agree that this is a story where the more you try to pick it apart, the less it holds up.
No. I mean, I think we're at our reckoning now.
Yes.
So
let's do the reckoning. So since you seem to have the more favorable reaction in the beginning, why don't you go first?
Well, we should say that the reckoning is whether or not we induct something into the comics canon and whether it has the qualities that we think are worthy of that. And our vote needs to be unanimous. And I think it's pretty clear neither of us are voting for this to be in the comics canon, you know. And it's not that we don't have, well, at least I have things that I like about it and enjoyed. And it's like, I read it very quickly, you know. I was like, I can't wait to see where this is going, you know.
And you did.
And some of the violent revenge stuff, it's like, I won't lie. It's like, I found it kind of cool, you know, on that kind of, on the level of the material that it is, you know? So that's this pulpy, you know, thing. And he's like, well, he's a good character to have in a situation like this where he's trying to reform and he's, you know, but it's one thing that's a little frustrating. It's like, he won't even fight back. You know, he won't even kind of avoid his punishment, or he won't use a jujitsu kind of thing to immobilize an opponent without physically harming them, you know. So that makes him seem irritatingly passive in it, you know.
Yeah, and I might be reading too much into this, but the subtext of that is that there's only complete passivity or giving into extreme gratuitous violence.
Yeah,
like, he can't just kind of use his wits to get out of problems, as you suggested earlier, because who wants to read that?
Yeah.
Certainly not someone who's reading a Mark Miller Wolverine comic, because as we've established, what Mark Miller thinks they want is, you know, some cool oh crap moments, cool action sequences, and, you know, gore and guts.
Yeah. So,
and I'm not against any of those things, but you know, the accumulation of them is a bit much.
Yeah.
So. And you were right. I was kind of hoping for a minute earlier on when you were talking that we were going to have a reversal of our Preacher episode where I was like, you know what? I kind of like this. And then I was like, what do you think, Kurt? And you were like, no. I was looking forward to saying,
we're both saying no.
But yes, I think it's pretty clear. While it does have some things to recommend it, it is outdone by its baser instincts, let's say.
One thing I will say, too, is, like, I can see a movie being made literally of this, not the movie Logan, which is not really at all like this, you know, but that would have like a Mad Max type budget, which would be live action, dial some of the stuff down a bit, you know, and it being super cool and exciting, you know.
Yeah, I would watch that all day.
But if they made a version of this, it would be kind of one of those probably like animated straight to DVD ones that would probably be violent in ways that are kind of gross, you know. Yeah. So it's like, yeah, I don't want to see an animated version of this, you know.
All right, so I think we've spent enough time on this. Yeah. So sorry, Wolverine Old Man Logan. Sorry, Mark Miller and Steve McNiven in particular, whose artwork I have no problems with. Yeah. Maybe better luck next time.
Yeah.
But no, Wolverine Old Man Logan does not make it into the comics canon. Okay.
I have a classic comics ad.
All right, let's do it.
I skipped one the last time because we were so excited. We had our Giggling Weldon as our guest, you know.
But, Giggling Weldon, did you say?
Yeah, Giggling Glenn Weldon. That's
that would be his Marvel roster in the bullpen.
Glenn Weldon, yes. Thank you, Glenn. This is a short one, and it has a guy holding what looks like a dollar bill. The reproduction that I'm looking at is not super great. And it says, Moneymaker. Insert a blank piece of paper, turn the knob, and out comes a real dollar bill. Insert the dollar, and it changes to a $5, and then the $5 changes to $10. And that's all it says. So it's like your little kid's home counterfeiting machine, it sounds like, you know.
Great. Yeah.
And it's like, so does it look? I think I actually know what this is, where I think you have to have the dollar bill and the $5 bill, like, preloaded, so you can impress someone by putting it in and it comes out, but it doesn't actually make money.
No.
You know, yeah. It doesn't do anything illegal, you know, unless you I guess swindle someone with it, you know. But
so that brings us to the Spinner Rack, our recommendations segment, where we steer you to comics or other media that you might like, as opposed to Old Man Logan.
Why don't you go first this time?
All right. As I mentioned earlier, when we were talking about Hawkeye, my recommendation is for relatively recent, in the last 6 years or so, Hawkeye Volume 1, My Life as a Weapon by Matt Fraction, with art by David Asia and Javier Pulido. It collects issues 1 through 5 of that run, that Hawkeye comic, and also Young Avengers Prevents number 6 by Fraction and Alan Davis, which concerns Kate Bishop, the Young Avengers version of Hawkeye. It's not even my favorite. Mm-hmm. That would have to be the second edition, which I also recommend, if only for the Pizza Dog story, which is one of my favorite single issues probably in the last 10, 15 years. But even though it's a different Hawkeye from the one that I grew up with in the 80s, it's still a pretty relatable character, and it's kind of a fun look at
he's like kind of an ordinary guy, you know, who happens to be a superhero with a bow and arrow kind of thing, but is like, it's almost like he's not really a superhero, and all the kind of, you know, collateral stuff of the Marvel Universe isn't really part of it, you know.
Right, and it's weird because it contradicts even the Hawkeye that you see in, say, Rick Remender's run on Secret Avengers. I don't know if you've read any of that. Or, for instance, even the Hawkeye that is in Brian Bendis's run on New Avengers. But you can see them being two sides of the same coin. It's fun to see that you've got, you know, this really action-oriented guy on one side, and the other you have this kind of hapless guy that things keep happening to.
Yeah.
I like it a lot.
Yeah. Well, I'm going to recommend something that we might do an episode on this further down the line, but it's Jonathan Hickman's Secret Wars miniseries. And
yeah, I think we should.
Yeah. This was kind of like built up over a number of years with like Avenger stories like Time Runs Out, and then he like had, you know, Secret Wars, and he brought back kind of the battle world concept from the original Secret Wars from the 80s, only this one it's like it's this planet made up of like chunks of other versions of the Marvel Universe's Earth, and I think even other planets. So it's like one big planet, and it has like things like the Marvel Zombies are a continent, and, you know, the Age of Ultron has a continent, and Old Man Logan is a continent. And so there was a Old Man Logan kind of spin-off series by Brian Michael Bendis that I meant to read, and I've heard good things, but I have not actually read, so I'm not going to recommend it here, but I may go out and get it, you know, soon. But Secret Wars, even though I didn't like the original Secret Wars that much, I was very impressed by the new one, and it does kind of this sort of crazy battle world concepts, you know, in an interesting way. And it works as this cool culmination and epilogue to Jonathan Hickman's Fantastic Four, which he had done a few years prior to that with like Dr. Doom and Reed Richards kind of having this, you know, final confrontation that's like almost literally at the heart of the Marvel Universe. So it like works super well, and I'm very impressed by it. So, you know, so that's what I'm going to recommend. And I also wanted to recommend the movie Logan, because I did see it. And I will just say that I'd call it the best X-Men movie since X2, X-Men United, and it is very strong.
Oh, good.
And something that's like peculiar, I didn't tell you I was going to recommend this, but I came across this last week, and it's a podcast. And there's a comedian and frequent podcast guest, Asterios Kokonos, and he had like a Patreon to support his comedic endeavors. And for that, he started something called the 5-Minute Podcast, where he would record a podcast for one person based on, you know, a topic of their choosing. And he then made some of them available to listen to last week, you know, for the kind of for the public listening and with the initial listener's permission. And someone asked him to do one about the idea that the movies of the Marvel Cinematic Universe would be better if they all had Willem Dafoe's Green Goblin from the first Spider-Man movie in it, saying things like, "I built this company," and "avenge me." And so he kind of like for 7 minutes or so goes through that concept, and it's pretty funny. And if you listen to this show, you would enjoy that. And I mentioned it because he mentions the Iron Patriot briefly on it. And we had our like back-to-back Norman Osborn episodes a few months ago. So that made me think of that. So the 5-Minute Podcast, Green Goblin episode specifically.
And Logan the movie?
And Logan the movie and Secret Wars.
Okay. And so you say it's the best since X2. How did you feel about, say, First Class?
First Class is good. Okay. Liked it, yeah.
Good.
But Logan and X2 are the best of the two.
Okay, great. Yeah. While we're doing that, I'm going to leap in real quick and recommend, and I think Kurt will co-sign this, the TV show Legion on Fox on, is it FX?
It is on FX, yes.
Yes. Starring Dan Stevens of Downton Abbey fame. Kurt has seen,
seen the first two as of this recording, and you've seen the first one.
Right. Yeah. And we're both like really anxious to see where it's going to go, but it's very well made and not at all what you think. And I hasten to add, because a friend of mine had this misconception, not at all related to the movie Legion
with
Paul Bettany. It's not an angels versus devils thing.
No.
It is definitely about mutants and mind powers, but not in the way that you might think.
And I don't know if we're going to see any like actual X-Men connection.
I don't see any indication that we are, aside from the little X in the Legion logo. All right, well, there you have it.
Well, next time we're going to have another movie kind of inform which comic book we talk about. And we're going to go into a different realm of comic book adaptation, because we're going to take the inspiration by the release of the upcoming release of the movie Wilson, based on a graphic novel by Dan Clowes. And so we're going to have a discussion that's going to focus on mostly on the first Dan Clowes adaptation, Ghost World. But we'll talk about Wilson in there, too, and maybe Art School Confidential, which are kind of the three movies based on Dan Clowes' works, you know,
right.
Ghost World being kind of
the most famous
and probably best and important, you know, but the other two are going to be in the mix also. Yeah.
So we'll be talking about at least those first two books, and what the heck, why not? Art School Confidential, pages
that'll
long?
That'll be like a 5-minute part of the conversation.
Yeah. So that'll be our Daniel Clowes episode next time.
Okay. Meanwhile, the Comics Canon can be found on the hoary hosts of podcasting, iTunes, SoundCloud, Google Play, and Stitcher, as well as our website, comicscanon.com.
Meanwhile, we want to hear from you. Rate and review the show on iTunes. That really helps us out a lot. You can also email us at letters@comicscanon.com. Post or comment on our Facebook page, or hit us up on Twitter @TheComicsCanon. We'll read your correspondence in a future episode. This podcast was edited by Grayson Bergman. For the Comics Canon, I'm Kevin Morrow.
And I'm Kurt Holman. The Comics Canon will be continued next time with Ghost World.
And Rosemary.